Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The big news today is Donald Trump saying more about accepting outcomes. He said in Ohio today he would accept a clear election result, but he won't commit to honoring the outcome because he wants to reserve his right to file a legal challenge in the case of a questionable result. This is coming out of the remarks last night at the presidential debate. And here to comment, he's watched the debate, he's writing about it, is New York Times Seattle-based columnist Tim Egan. Hey, Tim.
Hey, great to be with you, Bill.
So Trump says he will accept a clear election result. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, well, if you read into these remarks, he's actually saying something different. He's saying, heads I win, tails the whole thing is rigged, and so it doesn't really give you a choice. He's what he's saying in those words is, it's not rigged if I win. And, you know, he's got to dial this thing back because there's been a firestorm today. And one of the firestorm has gone all the way down into the Republican office holder ranks. And this is the big post-debate problem for him. If you question the validity of the American election itself, all those office holders who win election on November 8th, including presumably a majority of Republicans in the House, their outcome is questioned as well. They can't go to their voters and say, I'm a fraudulently elected member of Congress right now. So I would look in the next couple of days to see who, in addition to the already loud chorus of people denouncing, additionally denounces this thing. Now, Trump sort of walked into this because just before the debate, his own daughter, Ivanka, and his own campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, had both said, of course we will accept the outcome.
You're speaking quite rationally, Tim, about how questioning one election questions them all. But Trump has gotten this far not so much on rationality, but emotion. And to his average disenfranchised feeling supporter, doesn't it just make sense for him to say, well, I'll tell you how legitimate it was when we look at the evidence of the outcome at election time?
Yeah, I think it does. And I also think it feeds his grand narrative, which he's had from the beginning, which is the game is rigged against you. That the elites are out there doing something that's against your interests, whether they're global elites, whether they're people who are smarter than you, whether they're international bankers, which is often a code word for anti-Semitism, which he used about 10 days ago. It just feeds the very thing. Now, I looked at a poll yesterday on the percentage of Trump voters who believe that the election is rigged. And it's about the same percentage who believe that Obama is not an American citizen, that the president was born in Kenya. So there's a pretty strong group of people, millions and millions of Americans and his followers, for whom this is not a surprising thing at all, to question the very validity of a 240-year-old democracy.
What's your worst-case scenario for what actually flows from Trump questioning the legitimacy of this election? I mean, really, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, now I'm trying to take the high road on this because he's not being a patriot. I mean, we send people out to other people's elections to say, hey, we run good elections. Here's some monitors to make sure, the strong man doesn't do it. He had more praise last night for Vladimir Putin than he had for Ronald Reagan. And so my take on this is really anti-patriotic. I mean, it's continuing to tear down American institutions. He went after a free press. He said we have to tighten our libel laws. He's gone after due process. He says he wants to jail his opponent. He's gone after the idea of an impartial judiciary, saying a judge with Mexican heritage can't look at his case. So this is a continuation of tearing at American institutions. One of the things I say in my column tomorrow is that you can trace all this to the man at the top, Steve Bannon from Breitbart, who's the CEO of the campaign. And he's been quoted as saying, someone said, you're a populist, aren't you? And Breitbart said, no, I'm a Leninist. He said, what do you mean by that? He said, I want to tear everything down. I want to destroy the whole thing. And when you look at it through that lens, that makes sense.
Reading tomorrow's New York Times column today, because we have Tim Egan here in the studio with us. So let's talk about then. This was the final debate, which means the candidates are done talking to each other. We're not going to have any more. Ooh, who's going to dominate it? Who's going to throw somebody off their game? It's just rallies, ads, and get out the vote now. So given that, what could possibly keep Hillary Clinton from being president?
Yeah, Nate Silver, the great numbers guy, 538, just wrote a piece on that today. And what he said was that, put a fork in him, barring two things. One is an unforeseen event. We could have a horrible, God forbid, terrorist attack that gets enough people to think we need a strong man. Number two is the polling could be wrong. The colon could be dramatically wrong. This is what Silver says. But he says
the New York Times has it 92% chance of Clinton.
Right. And Nate Silver himself has it at about 85 today. It moves around in the mid-80s. And he said no one historically has ever come back this far from this far, this late in the election, because people tend to make up their minds after they want to see the two candidates. They make up their minds after the first debate, Bill. Mm. The second and third debate just confirm their biases. That's what all the polls show. Mm-hmm. That 90% of the people tell them they're not going to change. And my view is that the post-debate polls, there were two of them, showed Hillary winning by about a 9% margin. One was done by CBS. One was done by CNN. These are the scientific polls. Pretty much matches the way the electorate is right now. That there's about a 9-point spread. So the people who say they won are just confirming their bias. So
what does Trump do between now and November?
You know, can he say any more? Now, the other thing you raise this is that what can these words do? This could actually really discourage his people. If it's rigged, why should you vote?
Interesting.
You know, and that's what the party is worried about. The worried down ballot. There's a tough Senate race in Nevada right now. That's after polls are closed. And if the whole thing is rigged, why should you turn out for your guy? So they're really freaking out in the Republican Party right now about the down ballot effect of this right now. So it would take some huge news event again, or it would take some monumental historic change in patterns.
Well, he dropped something or tried to last night. I thought this was going to get more play. Trump accused Clinton's campaign of paying people to incite violence at his rallies.
Right.
Do you know any more about the truth?
Yeah,
it's
an interesting story. It broke a couple days ago. And it's this person who goes in and does these sort of snare ambush interviews.
Conservative group.
Right. And they did one of these with not a Hillary Clinton campaign operative, but with a Democratic Party subcontracted operative.
Yeah.
Who's quoted in the thing as saying, yeah, we go to these Trump rallies and we have a series of things we can say to get them all mad. So they have there's some key words that will get Trump people to commit violence. So it's dirty tricks.
Show up with a Trump is a Nazi shirt. He says you can message to draw them out
right.
And message them to punch you.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it is the kind of thing that you see in dirty tricks campaigns, whether it's Nixon's of 40 years ago or this now. But it's not a direct tie to Hillary Clinton. This is a subcontracted group, and it's one individual on tape talking about a handful of rallies. Now, does that make a rigged election? Of course not. But does that, if you think the election is rigged, will that feed your narrative that the whole thing is rigged? Unfortunately, it will.
So you think that Trump's only strategy, as we said, unless there's a terrorist attack, there's no more debates. You think his only strategy is to continue to, believe it or not, turn up the heat more and more on this democracy isn't working, this election is rigged?
Well, he's clearly not tried to reach out beyond his base. That's one of the great mysteries. I mean, Kellyanne Conway, his campaign manager, is a smart person, and she's tried to get him to reach out to women and Latinos and African Americans and millennials and all these huge groups of people that are in the polling shown that they're not going to vote for him. But he's incapable of doing but dialing down on his own base. Now, the other thing that's interesting I want to bring out is I thought, this is contrarian to what he's been putting out, he's the one who really lacks stamina. He looked like an old man to me last night. By the end of that debate, I thought he was really out of gas. He looked like the guy feeding nuts to the squirrels in the park. I mean, he's just sort of fumbling around at the very end. He's really good for 30 minutes. And he was really good for 30 minutes. But what happens, he's a 70-year-old man who brags about only getting 3 hours of sleep a night. And that shows his mind was fogged. And so he went for these easy little bait things that the hyper-prepared Clinton gave him. I mean, there he is going for it. You just put the little nut out there and he runs out and grabs it. So he was just out of gas by the end. And I think that stamina question is really interesting. But to go to your thing, what can he still do? He's said just about everything. He's crossed just about every boundary. He's pushed just about every wall of normalcy that any major party nominee has ever done. I don't know what remains.
Okay, so if he's out of gas, if this election is over, and it's Trump TV, mm-hmm. You've been thinking about this. We kind of talked about this the last time you were here.
Right.
You're starting to wonder and write about what is left, what remains of his accusations and that anger and the Republican Civil War next after the election.
It's the number one question, and it'll be with us for a long time. We talked about this last time you and I were together, that can you first of all, can you restore the civility? Once you say you should jail your opponent, and you have signs calling Hillary, you know, an unprintable name. But the more interesting game for Trump is, can he monetize this anger? Can he monetize this hatred? Well, this is a guy that's filed for bankruptcy six times. His empire is in somewhat trouble right now. I see Fox possibly breaking up over this. Now, you've got the Roger Ailes, the former head of it, out over sex harassment allegations. You've got the sort of the intelligent wing, the good journalist wing, which I thought, you know, last night's debate moderator was he was fantastic.
After all the questions about the first Fox News moderator, he was good, right?
He was really good. Chris Wallace was, let's give him a kudos where it's deserved. He's a really skilled interrogator. So is Megyn Kelly. So I could see Fox breaking up, and this sort of, you know, Chris hard good journalist going one way, and then Trump TV taking the others. That said, Oprah Winfrey, one of the most beloved figures in America, and with more than $50 million in startup money, has not been able to make much of a success yet of her own network. Also, people have pointed out Sarah Palin tried to start her own network. And once you lose an election and the tab, the worst thing Trump fears, what's on his front? Loser.
Loser.
Once you have that, can you go out and, you know, venture capital, raise money, et cetera, to do this?
Tim Egan, will you go write your New York Times column for tomorrow? You got to finish it up.
I know. If you let me get out of here in time, I only got an hour and 10 minutes to go.
Let the man hit send on the thing. Tim Egan, we're so happy you come in and talk with us.
Great.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW. And, of course, it wasn't just Clinton and Trump debating last night. Not even on KUOW. If you stayed tuned, you heard our governor, Jay Inslee, and the Republican challenger, Bill Bryant, debating in Pasco, their third and final debate. Northwest News Network correspondent Anna King was there, and she says the candidates didn't call each other names or anything, but there was a sense of challenge.
Bill Bryant was very aggressive, very lawyerly, was kind of poking at Jay Inslee, saying, hey, we need a governor who can stand up and do this job. And Jay Inslee was like, hey, we have been doing a great job.
The debate covered four major issues. Let's start with number one. Washington State has a moratorium on the death penalty. How did they talk about whether the death penalty ought to resume or the moratorium should continue?
You know, Republican Bill Bryant says that we should uphold the state laws and continue to have those executions. And there was some applause from the audience on that remark. Then Jay Inslee said, you know, executions aren't conducted fairly across class and race lines here in the Washington state. He says research shows that that it's not fair. And so he continues to hold that his moratorium on executions is the right thing to do.
What did the candidates say about cleaning up the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, which is right in the backyard of where this debate happened?
You know, you could have heard a pin drop in the room. Everybody was really on their seat to hear about this. This is one of the largest industries here in the Tri-Cities and in eastern Washington in general. And, you know, the state has two lawsuits against the federal government right now. One on missed federal deadlines for cleanup of tank waste, and another on worker safety at those same tanks. And Bill Bryant said these lawsuits that the state is waging against the federal government is just distracting to other cleanup that needs to happen along the Columbia River, like the Kay Basin sludge just 400 yards away from the river. Jay Inslee, on the other hand, said, hey, sometimes you have to hold feet to the fire to get things done and not kick it down the road a little bit. And so he said, I've spent two decades of work on Hanford issues, and we need these lawsuits to make sure that the federal government sits up and listens to what we need. We need to have safety at these Hanford waste tank farms, and we also need to have federal dollars here at Hanford cleaning things up. We can't have that money drift away to some other project.
These governor candidates also debated Yakima water quality. How does that involve the governor, and why should somebody in Western Washington care about that?
If you drink milk or if you eat meat, you should care about what's happening in the Yakima Valley. Much of Seattle's milk and meat come from right there in this area. In this area from Parker Heights outside of Yakima to Grandview and Prosser, there's nitrates that are polluting the groundwater. That comes from fertilizers and from manure. And there's a shallow aquifer there. And many people have private wells in this area that are drawing up these nitrates into their drinking and cooking water. That's a problem if you have a baby or children, because they're specifically susceptible to this you know, lack of oxygen in the blood if you drink nitrate polluted water. Now, the state is developing new laws to clean up the shallow aquifer and those private wells. And it's a communications battle because many of these people are Spanish speakers and they don't, know that they should test the well, or they haven't heard yet that they should test the well. So there's been a huge campaign by the state to inform them. And these rules might come out in a year. And so the dairies and the meat operations are really against new regulations. And some of the environmentalists are saying, hey, these regulations are not near stringent enough. And so on the issue, Bill Bryant said, I'm going to put a moratorium on any new regulations that would affect businesses down in the valley. And Jay Inslee said, hey, having clean water is a basic human right, and we need to make sure that everybody has clean drinking water that they can depend on when they turn on the tap. And so I think these regulations are just in time.
Finally, Anna, the presidential debate last night touched on disenfranchised voters, and so did our governor debate. Yakima went through a big redistricting intended to enfranchise Latino voters there. Did the candidates disagree about that?
No, actually, the candidates both agreed very strongly that redistricting needs to happen in all communities across the state, possibly, to include Latinos and other minorities into these civic discussion, that they need to have representation on city councils, on school boards, and both candidates acknowledged that the huge growth in the Latino population, and that the Latino vote needed to be stronger so that they could elect representation that covered the issues they care about in their neighborhoods.
Anna King, Richland correspondent for the Northwest News Network. She was in Pasco last night at the third and the final Washington State Governor's Debate. It's KUOW's The Record. Yesterday, hundreds of Seattle public school teachers wore Black Lives Matter shirts to class, and they gave lessons on race and equity. KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld went to a school in White Center to listen to teachers and students.
White Center Heights Elementary is just south of Seattle in the Highline School District. Most of the students are kids of color. Teachers greeted students with a huge banner as they arrived at school, and the kids posed in front of it with big smiles on their faces. Inside the building, teacher Ryan Riley read his first graders the bell hooks book, Skin Again. The previous day, the class had discussed things they'd heard said about their skin color.
And I was really touched by what you shared with me and with the class in terms of what people have said.
Riley read from the list.
You have nasty black skin. That somebody in our class had that said to them. Oh, you're black, so you are the color of poop. Oh, somebody said that outside someone's apartment, right? How do these things make us feel?
Sad.
The kids offered theories about why people might say those kinds of things.
Because they just don't like your outside, but they're not looking on the inside.
Yeah.
Or maybe they got bullied by somebody else.
In another classroom, Sally Wilma's 5th and 6th graders discussed police brutality.
Sometimes I'm kind of thinking, why are police officers around if they're going to do something that's not necessary?
Yeah, police officers, we need them, but they shouldn't be killing black people. Like, they react so fast. Like, I agree, like, if, like, there's something in a black person's hand, then they just react that it's a gun and they don't really know what it is.
Other students wanted to know why people are called black or white when their skin is actually brown or pink. And why did white people enslave black people to begin with? Every time one student finished speaking, Sally Wilma could hardly keep up as hands shot up all over the classroom, kids eager to answer each other's questions.
I'm so proud of you all that you're thinking this way and that you're willing to do something about it, because there was, I think, a generation that was very complacent and didn't. And I'm glad there's activism.
Wilma promised her students that this wouldn't be the last day they saw their teachers in Black Lives Matter shirts. She said this is a long conversation that's just getting started. I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
The color is not what matters of your skin. It's your personality.
What do you think of Seattle area teachers wearing Black Lives Matter t-shirts? I asked you that yesterday, and Jason wrote to say it is inappropriate and illegal for teachers to wear a shirt conveying a message such as Black Lives Matter. Those teachers can choose to do any sort of protest they like on their own time. Enough with the distractions. Get back to work. But a Seattle parent named Krista disagrees. She lives in West Seattle.
And as the mother, white mother of a black child, I think it's really important that the school district do something like what they're doing today. I think it sends a message to the minority children of this community that we all care about them. And I can't think of a better, stronger message.
A listener named Darcy writes to us, were parents informed that their children would be involved in a protest? No. Is it fair to assume that outside agitators with an agenda to cause unrest can walk into our public schools and solicit the youth for their self-interested cause? No. There are laws, rules, and procedures regarding politics in the classroom. And finally, here is Kristen from Seattle.
I'm a white parent with kids at Exetyan Middle School, and I'm thankful to the educators who are wearing Black Lives Matter t-shirts and signs today. I want my kids to live in a world where everyone is valued regardless of the color of their skin.
A world where everyone is valued regardless of the color of their skin. That's a goal that our next guest certainly supports. Robin DiAngelo consults on issues of racial and social justice. Yesterday on this show, she said that talking to kids about racism isn't enough because many parents pass on racism to our children in other ways, like surrounding themselves solely with other white people.
Odds are you probably are raising them in segregation, as most white people raise their children in segregation. So we tell them that everyone's equal, but we don't live our lives as if that's actually the truth, right? We don't live our lives together. We don't seek out to build those relationships across race. And the fundamental message is that there isn't really any value in doing that. Those are the deeper messages our children are getting.
Robin DiAngelo says white people need to really think about how being white shapes their lives and experiences and the lives and experiences of people of color.
There's an activist, Pat Parker, and she puts it like this. First of all, forget that I'm black. All right. And I think what she means by that is stop reducing me to that. Stop having everything be about that. Stop always labeling me that way. And second, don't you ever forget that I'm black. And that I have a different experience than you do and a different worldview and a different reality. And that's that tension, right? That balance of not reducing but never forgetting or not pretending that none of this matters, right? It's that balance. And again, if this was easy, I think we'd be in a different place than we are. But it does require the willingness to be uncomfortable and to not know and to be in that place of racial humility. This is one of the greatest challenges for white people. We don't have a lot of humility on this topic. When we live our lives so separately, we don't really understand our histories except in the most superficial ways. And yet we all have opinions that we so arrogantly just trot forth as if they're as valid as anybody else's.
Do you think when I feel uncomfortable saying I'm white, you know, some part of me immediately wants to make a joke out of it or be sarcastic about it? Do you think there's, you know, and I feel I want to get beyond these labels. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's something either unconscious or dishonest with me that's going on?
Well, it goes against all your conditioning, right? You have had that deep access to a sense of yourself as an individual, as special and unique, right? And to say that being white means something, you have to give up a little bit of that individualism. And it's also an ideology that's rather sacred, right? It's like, you know, it's a terrible breach for you to suggest, you know, you're generalizing, that's wrong. So there are all of these beliefs that make it really hard for you to do that, right? So you have to give up a little bit of that. You have to proceed as if it actually matters that you're male, right? That you're all of these able-bodied, that you're white, and that they shape the way you experience the world. And it wasn't just your special hard work that, you know, you're swimming in a current, and the current moves you along so that, yes, you work hard and it pays off in a particular way, a way that we can clearly predict and measure that it's most likely going to pay off.
It's going to work out for me.
Yeah.
Boy.
Yeah.
you tossed off the observation that you probably live in segregation. But there's a bunch of our listeners who live in, hey, I'm in a really diverse zip code. I don't live in segregation. That's not me. What do you say to that?
Oh, well, almost any diverse zip code that a white person lives in is no longer going to be a diverse zip code soon. And on some level, we know that, which is why we're there. Yes, living in...
Well, that's interesting. So you're there to be part of that changing diverse zip code.
You know it's coming up and you got in at a good time. It's probably less expensive than other neighborhoods. But,
ouch.
Well, yeah. So living in a diverse environment is certainly, I think... offers opportunities that you don't have when you don't live in a diverse environment, but that doesn't mean we're actually living an integrated life. And that's one of the common patterns when whites come into formerly people of color neighborhoods and gentrify them. They don't patronize the small businesses owned by people of color. They don't get involved in local community events, and they don't send their children to those schools, right? And so they actually don't integrate. It's like an image I show when I'm doing my presentations of all of these very hugely popular, famous shows about ideal friendship that many of us grew up with across the decades. Seinfeld, Sex in the City, Friends, Gossip Girl, Girls. Every one of those shows takes place in New York City, and every one of them is a completely white friendship circle.
It's a surprisingly lily white place, Manhattan.
Right. So even in the midst of diversity, always the message coming at us is there's no inherent value in an integrated life, that the ideal world, the world that we call good. Notice the power of that message. To call a segregated neighborhood, which is what most of us live in, good and sheltered, that there's a message there, right? Why would we see it as good if it's segregated? Why was it a tragedy to have segregation imposed on blacks in the Jim Crow South, but it's something to be celebrated in our lives?
Is it okay to look forward to the day when race doesn't matter and I don't identify as white?
Yes, but we are not there yet. And to proceed as if we are only obscures what's actually going on and holds it all in place, right? And we will not get to that place without action, without you and I actually interrupting the patterns of this in our own lives, right? So to just be aware of things like white privilege and white advantage and be able to say, oh, yeah, I know I have it, and then proceed the way you've always proceeded, that will not change the way the system is. We actually have to look at the really deep issues.
You've told me, Robin, that a real common question you get is, hey, aren't we, by dividing into races, I'm white, this person's that, we are dividing ourselves. That's a bad thing, right?
That's another just classic white narrative, right? We live divided lives, right? I think most of your listeners, if they really look at who's at your table, and I don't mean setting your table, I mean sitting at your table, breaking bread with you, who is in your life, where are those close, intimate relationships? We're already separate by race. So to not talk about that only holds it in place. And what other social dilemma do we think the best strategy for would be to never discuss? Domestic violence? Child abuse? Is the best strategy to never discuss these things? You know, when you're on the airplane and they say you need to put your oxygen mask on first and then turn and put it on others, that's what I would say to parents, right? We always want to, you know, how do I teach my children as if we're in good shape and we just have to then like say the right thing to them. But where are we? Do we have our oxygen masks on? What work have we done? What deep soul searching? How have we set up our lives? Who's in our children's world?
Is this especially a problem in Seattle? White people who don't want to deal?
No, I used to teach in Massachusetts.
But I've heard that said about Seattle.
Well, what Seattleites are able to do, white Seattleites are able to say, gosh, there just aren't very many here. So we can cover it that way. When I was back east, the segregation is so explicit. I mean, you have cities that are 57% black and Latino, and block by block, you have either all white or all black and brown. So it's harder to deny on the East Coast, right? But Seattle, we have...
So we're better off in Seattle. We're advanced.
No, we have a very deep history. There's lots going on here. We have lots of opportunities to challenge this segregation. There's your other red flag. Whenever you feel complacent as a white person, you should think, okay, what about this narrative is making me feel better about myself and therefore less responsible to have to do anything to interrupt it? We have plenty of opportunities in Seattle to interrupt racial segregation. Seattle public schools are under federal investigation right now for racial disparity. This does translate into people's lives, right? This lack of understanding of the reality of people of color, combined with deep implicit bias that no white person can miss because the images circulate around us 24/7, it does translate into how we go forth and do business. So no, Seattle is not off the hook. In fact, I think white liberals are the most challenging because the degree to which we think we're good to go because we're open-minded and we shop at PCC and, you know, we bring our own bags and we're going to spend all of our time trying to convince other people of that and not any time doing what we need to be doing for the rest of our lives, which is deep, deep soul searching and active interruption of the patterns that keep us complicit.
Robin DiAngelo developed the City of Seattle's Race and Social Justice Initiative Anti-Racism Training. Okay, what do you want to say about race? What's your story? How do you agree or disagree with what you just heard? You can be anonymous if you want to. Write to us, record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org, or call us 206-221-3663, 221-3663. It's KUOW Seattle 94.9. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us. In a big city like Seattle, you might expect that heroin is rampant. Well, the King County Heroin Task Force says that heroin has caused more overdose deaths than any other drug for the past 2 years. But in smaller towns, heroin is very easily available as well. That can be shocking for the families who live in those towns. Radioactive's Brian Freeland introduces you to one of those families.
I went to Kentwood High School in Covington, Washington. This is where I first met Alyssa Gardinier. I was a naive freshman. She was a cool junior. A child of theater, smiling, cheerful, and happy. Or so I thought. Little did I know of the dark secret that possessed her ever since childhood. When she was 10 years old, she found the spot where her parents hid the alcohol. The moment it first touched her lips, she was addicted to that escape. In middle school, smoking weed took away her social anxiety and allowed her to be the person she'd always wanted to be. It escalated from weed to other popular drugs such as Molly, ecstasy, and meth, but nothing could give her the escape she craved. So she turned to heroin when she was 14.
What people don't tell you about heroin, they tell you all the scary stuff, but the scariest thing that they don't tell you is that you are gonna love it. Like, you're gonna love it so much, and it will trick you because you just think, oh, this is nice. It's not that big of a deal.
Heroin, like the weed in middle school, made her more comfortable. She could finally talk to people, something she'd been struggling with for a while. She was happier, more liked, both by herself and others.
I thought it was a blessing because I could focus in school.
Eventually, she went back for more, doing anything she could to pay for that escape. She used her own money for heroin. Her reasoning was that it was hers to do what she wished with. Then she started selling her parents things, stealing, and even begging on the streets.
I did some pretty bad things. You know, things that I would have never imagined myself doing, but it just escalates and escalates. And that desperation and the way that the drugs make you feel, it doesn't even matter at that moment what you do. You just have to get money anyhow, any way to get your dope. That's what you have to do in your head.
She was unpredictable, a wild card.
My own family didn't even know who I was anymore. I didn't even know who I was anymore.
Her mom discovered some dirty needles and confronted her. At first, Alyssa was tempted to lie, but decided to finally come clean.
I got honest for the first time, probably ever, about this. And I went to her and we cried together. We talked about what we were going to do. We discussed treatment. And that's the first time we really, like, came together and tried to come up with a plan.
As much as it frightened her mother, it might have had the biggest impact on her dad.
He was pretty devastated. He had been an alcoholic pretty much my whole life. And so there was a lot of guilt there, and he thought that maybe it was his fault. Me watching him could have led to me using. It wasn't until I went to treatment and we all met with a counselor that I realized really how much it was affecting him in every aspect of his life.
Her journey began with a 134-mile drive to a treatment center in Yakima.
And I had no intentions of staying here, but as time went on, I realized that I really did want to stay sober this time.
But her journey was long from over.
I got a little bit cocky, and I thought that I did have it on my own. I made it to about 9 months of sobriety, and I had a job. I had a house to live in. I had real friends. I had built my life up, and I had a lot to lose.
And then Alyssa relapsed.
And that's just the way addiction works. You fool yourself into thinking that something will never, ever happen again, or it won't be me, or I won't do this. And that's just justifying your use, and you'll be exactly back where you were, or you'll be sleeping on a church bench, not knowing where to go or what to do.
Alyssa decided to try again. Today, Alyssa is 20 years old and living 11 months clean in Yakima, working as a daycare teacher and living every day to the fullest.
I don't feel this constant pressure to have to go out and do something or be somebody that I'm not, or I can just focus on being me.
Through the many struggles life's thrown at her, as well as this major roadblock, she made it and has come through a better person. From Radioactive, this is Brian Freeland.
And what is Radioactive? That is KUOW's youth media program. You can find us on Facebook at Radioactive Youth Media. If you're a parent, you're going to worry about your kid's social life. And that can be hard, all the more so if you're raising a transgender child. Marlo Mack is a single mom who produces a podcast called How to Be a Girl. In this excerpt from her podcast, Mack talks about why friends are so important for her daughter.
If you're the parent of a young child, you know about playdates. Your kiddo comes home from school talking about a new best friend and begs to have the child over to play. If you don't know the parents, you do some recon. And if everything seems okay, you reach out and set something up and hope for the best. But if you have a child like mine, playdates often come about nothing like this.
Is it her? Is she here?
When Tess came over to play,
hello.
Well, hello there.
She and my daughter had never laid eyes on each other.
Nice to meet you.
And her dad, Gabriel, and I had met just once.
Cool. Thanks so much for coming.
And we'd only spoken briefly.
We have a little picnic on the back deck if you guys want to have some food.
Mostly about our daughters.
Had a little bit of food, Tess.
But I still set aside an entire Saturday for them.
So are you both the exact same age? How old?
And Gabriel drove over an hour to get to our house.
You're both going into the third grade. That's great.
And it's not because we live in rural areas.
Looking around, are you guys vegetarian?
Like us, they live in an urban neighborhood, teeming with other eligible 8-year-old girls to book playdates with.
Really?
But not girls like ours.
Are you excited to meet me?
Yes. So, I'm sitting here with the two most beautiful girls sitting on my couch, and I'm so thrilled. I was wondering if you could each tell me, what did it feel like to tell your parents that you were transgender?
Good.
I felt relieved.
Sometimes I think these playdates are actually for me.
Is it okay if it's not the exact color?
Because when they play together, our girls look and sound just like any other pair of little girls.
I don't know what that is, but I love it already.
It's us parents who sound different.
How do you handle the swimsuit thing?
Like all parents, we swap notes.
It's like a little skirt kind of, that surrounds the bottom of the swimsuit.
But our standard topics...
She's comfortable with that?
Totally comfortable with it.
...are pretty different.
Yeah, we've been doing like the swim shorts.
Is your spouse on board?
Just once, I put her in pants.
What about your extended family?
Because it was snowing outside.
She didn't wear pants either.
Oh, my God.
Did you have to leave your church?
Yeah.
It's purely dresses, skirts, leggings.
Do the other kids at school know?
Never, ever, ever.
I can't get mine in pants either.
Yeah.
Have you changed the birth certificate yet?
Pants are toast. Forget it.
How bad is the bullying? And inevitably, there's the sharing of the Genesis story. The day you knew this was for real. A lot of these stories are remarkably similar.
I'll never forget the day. I'll never forget where we were on the road.
But, although not many of us were as cool as this dad was.
She just said, hey, Papa, I have something I really want to tell you.
I know I wasn't.
I was like, what's up? And she said, it's not just that I feel like a girl. I am a girl. And my name is Tess. And I was like, okay, fantastic. Yes, it is. Let's do this.
Playdates like this are such a relief, because for once, I just don't have to worry. The fact is that not all parents are going to be okay letting my daughter play with their daughters once they find out she's transgender. For now, sometimes I tell them, sometimes I don't. And so far, it's been just fine. But I still worry and wait for the day when a parent closes the door on their child's friendship with mine. When that day comes, we'll call Tess.
What's it like to get to hang out with each other today?
It's awesome.
Yeah, it's so fun.
Why is it so fun? Why is it so awesome?
We just hugged each other, and probably because we can relate in a lot of things. Our parents are both divorced. We're both awesome.
Yeah.
We like each other. We both like Legos.
Yep.
We're both trans.
Yeah. Most everything.
We're just friends.
The podcast How to Be a Girl is a collaboration between KUOW and independent producer Marlo Mack. You can find out more about the podcast and how to subscribe at our website, KUOW.org. And one more bit of news in the world of gender today. The UN is about to hold a ceremony to appoint Wonder Woman its honorary ambassador for the empowerment of women and girls. Some women rights advocates would like to know how a half-naked, stereotypically sexualized white American cartoon woman could be a fitting role model. We'll get into that today on KUOW's All Things Considered. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. When Eli Roebuck is 9 years old, Mr. Krantz shows up at his house. Eli watches as his mom leaves with Mr. Krantz. Mr. Krantz is no ordinary man. He is a Sasquatch.
I was really attracted to some of the Spokane and Colville Indian tribal legends concerning Sasquatch, and they really saw him as more of a man than an animal. And they saw him as a fallen figure. As you get to know him in the novel, he is much more like a man than he is an animal. And in some ways, you know, there are some characters in the novel who are maybe more monstrous than he is, even just as people.
That's Spokane-based writer Sharma Shields. Her novel is called The Sasquatch Hunter's Almanac, and it just won the 2016 Washington State Book Award for Fiction. It tells the story of Eli Roebuck and Mr. Krantz, but Shields told Jeannie Yandel the book also explores the idea of monsters.
They're almost illustrations of our deepest fears. They're kind of manifested in this creaturely form that is instantly attainable. And I am really attracted to talking about vulnerabilities and fears in my writing. So for me, they're kind of really beautiful as metaphors. Maybe that's why I loved them as a child. I was always kind of a dark kid. I really liked the unhappy endings and some of the Greek myths that I read. And I trusted those unhappy endings more than I trusted Disney fairy tale endings. But for some reason, those dark endings spoke a higher truth to me as a child, and they do now to me, too.
What's the higher truth they speak to you?
Well, just that the world can be a pretty scary place, and that we are vulnerable as people, and that we kind of have to learn, this is going to sound corny, but that we kind of have to learn to love one another despite our own fallibilities and despite the fallibilities of other people.
The book follows Eli Roebuck. We first meet him when he's 9 years old and Mr. Krantz, the Sasquatch, shows up in his living room. But Eli grows up and he tries to track down Mr. Krantz. You have several other characters in the book who have their own encounters with monsters, with monstrosities, I guess. I'm thinking specifically of Gladys, Eli's first wife. She starts seeing monsters. At one point, she sees herself as a monster. Mm-hmm. That seemed like a way to deal with some pretty terrifying adult issues. She goes through a miscarriage. Mm-hmm. She has a child who she cares very little for. She seems to be going through some pretty intense postpartum depression. Do you have kids?
I do. I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. And I was definitely taking from my own experience with postpartum depression, which I had terribly after the birth of my second child, my daughter. I think there's a passage in the book about the ever mutating fear of motherhood. You know, you have one fear at a certain age and then it morphs into a different sort of fear as the child grows up. And there was a point when I was dealing with the depression where I was just really extremely paranoid. And I actually think that Gladys loves her daughter very much in the book, but she suffers from some extreme mental illness, and she's incapable of finding a way to love without that really gripping fear. And you can see that when she's with the newborn baby. She's afraid to even hold the baby because she's worried she's going to do it incorrectly. And those were all feelings, you know, I had as a new mom. I mean, with my son, I had never even changed a diaper before when I had a baby. So I remember the nurse bringing him into the room and just setting him down on my belly and telling me, now just go to sleep with him lying against you, skin to skin. And she left the room and I just had these bulging eyes and was staring at the ceiling thinking, what have I gotten myself into? I have no idea how to do this at all. And that experience is definitely in the book, as Gladys's experience too.
So what did it do for you to be able to explore those experiences you had?
I think it's really interesting how much of my personal life and my emotions are on the page. And I've wondered sometimes if that's why I love magic realism or, you know, the surreal or whatever you want to call it. But I wonder if it gives me a little bit of a buffer so I can explore those emotions in almost a safe environment on the page. So I don't know yet. I'm not sure if I'm trying to, if it's my own type of therapy to write about it, art therapy, I guess, but or if it's it's just I don't sometimes know what to do with those emotions in real life. They sometimes feel too powerful for me to just sit with and just feel in a room. That just sounds so uncomfortable to me. But if I can write them down, then that's I feel like they have a direction and I enjoy it a lot more.
I'm talking with Sharma Shields. She's a Spokane-based author. Her latest book is called The Sasquatch Hunter's Almanac. We've been talking a lot about monsters. What benefit do you think monsters provide? What do they do for adults?
You know, it's funny. I remember listening to a radio program a couple years ago, and they were talking about how in times of distress and times of war or of economic crisis, monster stories tend to rise up to the surface again. And I think it is kind of what I suggested earlier. It's some sort of manifestation of our fears coming back. So to some degree, while I think that's very interesting, I also think that monster stories have always fascinated us and been interesting to us because they're this great double-edged sword of intrigue and mystery and excitement and also danger and fear and vulnerability. And those are some of my favorite themes to explore while writing fiction. So for me, it's just a really fun way to explore a fictional world.
You've mentioned vulnerability a few times, mm-hmm. which makes me think of my own daughter. I imagine when you think about vulnerability, you might think about your own kids.
Yeah.
How do you talk to your kids about monsters, about vulnerability, about all of these scary things?
It's funny. I just had a piece in the New York Times about this, how for a little while there I was trying to hide my MS diagnosis from the children. And I have to take a daily shot of a drug called Copaxone. And so my husband would distract the children and then I would go into the bedroom and take my shot and then come out a couple minutes later. And they would be none the wiser of it. But one day my son just burst into the room, my five-year-old, and he came running up to me saying, "Mommy, Mommy, what are you doing?" right as I injected the shot into my underarm. And he jumped up on the bed with me and watched me do the shot. And I explained to him that Mommy takes this shot every day because she has a disease and it keeps her from getting sicker. And my husband came in and he was holding my daughter and he said, "Isn't your mommy tough?" And Henry was like, "She's so tough." You know, like he was just like, "She takes a shot every day." And he was so impressed. And then that was it. He ran out of the room and Louise, my daughter, went to play with him too. And they just rolled with it. And it was, I realized then how silly it was to try to hide it from them, that in a way I was almost making it scarier by shutting the door and locking them out of the room. It was much better to have them just aware that, yes, there are these dark things in life, but here's the beautiful thing. We have one another and we have a choice to be brave about it and stick together and love one another. And I think that's where I kind of find a lot of beauty in life and goodness and in humankind, because that also exists out there, along with all the insecurities and cruelties and everything else as well.
Sharma Shields wrote the book, The Sasquatch Hunter's Almanac, that just won the 2016 Washington State Book Award for Fiction. She talked with Jeannie Yandel last year, and we're going to tweet out a link to that New York Times piece Sharma Shields wrote last year called The Dark Side of Parenting. So glad you tuned in today to KUOW's The Record. We got into a lot of important stuff today. We asked for your thoughts after our talk about race with Robin DiAngelo, and I said you could be anonymous, and we got two listeners who took us up on that. One writes, "The woman on your show talking about race was infuriating. She makes so many assumptions and generalizations. I have three brothers and three sisters. One of them is black. There are many mixed families where I live. My brother conducts his life just like his white siblings. He has the same opportunities. I believe your guest's attitude is a big part of the problem." But another listener says, "I wish sometimes that Seattle people were more warm, less racist, and realized how much harder it is being a person of color here versus other major cities. I've lived all over the country. I've never felt so uncomfortable or aware of my race than Seattle, a city booming with opportunity and adequate resources. I don't feel like I belong here. I never have, so I'm leaving." What about you? Tell us your story, your take. Write to us at record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org, or give us a call, 206-221-3663. Tell us your story, 221-3663. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you'll get a podcast of KUOW's The Record and all of our great shows.